Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What separates the very best American presidents from their less than stellar counterparts? And how did the presidency come to comprise the duties and authorities it does today? For many of the founding fathers, the most important thing about establishing a presidency was ensuring that the powers of America's chief executive were nothing like those afforded a king, under whom they had suffered grievously during the colonial era. And while we have held fast to that ideal, my guest today is here to tell us how the presidency has continued to evolve since George Washington first held the office. Kenneth C. Davis is author of the new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Ken, welcome back to Think.
It's always a great pleasure, Chris. Thanks for having me. And if you haven't noticed, we're in the midst of an election.
Yes, it's a little hard to ignore around here. You know, we have so many expectations and traditions today wrapped up in the presidency. But in 1789, George Washington had to sort of make the whole thing up as he went along. How did he define for us what it means to be president of the United States?
Well, that's a great question, but it goes back a little bit before that to the men who invented or perhaps improvised this job in the summer of 1787 at the Constitutional Convention. And Washington, of course, was there presiding over that convention. These were men, as you mentioned in the introduction, who feared one thing more than any other, that they were creating an American king. Of course, to go back 225 years ago, the Articles of Confederation were the idea that America was operating under. We'd come through the Revolution, but many of those revolutionary generations men were afraid that the country was falling off the rails, and they got together in secret in Philadelphia, in the same building where they had drafted and adopted the Declaration 11 years earlier, to reinvent American government. And part of that was coming up with the idea of the presidency. And they wanted this man, and certainly they only thought about him as a man, to be someone who could act with what they called vigor. That's a word that probably meant something a little different from what we think of today. They wanted, as Alexander Hamilton put it, they wanted someone with energy, dispatch, secrecy, somebody who could respond to a crisis and act quickly rather than waiting for Congress to dither and debate for a long time. If the nation were attacked, this would be a man who was in command of the army, for instance. So they went back for a long time, back and forth on the issues, how much power he would have, how long he would serve, and the most significant of all, and we're still dealing with it, who would choose him.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about that. First of all, the founding fathers were essentially very much one percenters. Is that right in their day?
They were very much the 1%. There's no question that these were the elites of their time. And even as they spoke about who should vote and who should be in the government, they were really wondering about these questions. And there were certainly people on one end of the spectrum, like James Wilson of Pennsylvania, one of the most interesting founders or framers of the Constitution we never hear of. He was a Scotsman who came to America, had very idealistic visions. He was a signer of the Declaration of Independence. He proposed on the very first day of the Constitution that the president be elected by the people. And that idea was quickly shot down because, and Pennsylvania at that time was the only state that elected its governor by popular vote. All the others, the legislature picked the governor, which was how many of the other framers of the Constitution wanted the president to be chosen. So they came up with the compromise. If they didn't want the people to do it, and they didn't want the legislature to do it, who was it going to be? Well, they compromised on something that we now call electors.
Yes, the Electoral College system. And essentially, the idea was still that regular individuals might not make the smartest decision?
That was absolutely the idea. In fact, Roger Sherman of Connecticut rather famously said, the people are easily liable to be misled. He didn't have a great deal of faith in the average American at that time. And to go back to your other question, there were certainly all kinds of thoughts about who should actually vote, who should participate in the government. And even though that was eventually left up to the states, there were proposals that you have to have $100,000 worth of property to be able to participate. That was an idea put forth at the convention. Now, $100,000 in property in 1787, you figured out the inflation rate over 225 years. That would certainly put you in the 1%, I'm sure. So these men were certainly the elitist of their days. Once they were described as the well-fed, the well-read, the well-bred, and the well-wed, because some of them had married very, very well, including Washington. Martha was much, much wealthier than George was when they were married. But it was a love match. We won't say it was just about the Benjamins. But these were men who feared democracy. We have to be that blunt about it. They did not think that the average person was capable of making such an important decision. Most people, of course, were not well educated at the time. There was no widespread public education in that time. There was no mass media, of course. There were newspapers that were just starting to start up. But there were practical reasons then that a person in Massachusetts, for instance, really couldn't know a politician from Virginia or Carolina or Georgia. And so that was part of the practical reason, but it was really more this very, very fundamental idea that this was too important a decision to be left up to the riffraff.
So these days, Ken, we are a much more small-D democratic country. We have access to information about everything from the candidates' third-grade math test scores to their shoe size. Why have multiple efforts to get rid of the Electoral College system failed?
Well, it's entrenched because, first of all, it's in the Constitution, and so that would require amending the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College. That's not really in the interests of a lot of the people who have to make that decision, so it's really been unchanged. I think that until the year 2000, of course, when we had the very controversial Gore-Bush election, the popular vote had really been borne out by the Electoral College, so it didn't seem to be such an issue. Of course, 2000 put it front and center once again. And there was some discussion at the time of going back and looking at it again, but then I think the nation got caught up in 9/11, understandably, and two wars and an economic crisis, and the idea of changing the Constitution for the Electoral College really receded from a priority on the to-do list. There is an interesting piece of legislation that's going around right now that each state that signs onto this legislation says it will give its electors to the popular winner. Now, if they get enough states to sign on to that to equal the 270 needed for victory, that would really kind of take care of changing the Constitution. I don't see that happening. About nine states have signed on to that for so far. But to go back to this point about the electors and who they were and how they were going to be chosen, so many of these decisions about who the president was going to be and what his role was were made by men who, as you said, really feared a king. Benjamin Franklin on the very first day says, "We know the first man at the helm will be a good one," and nobody had to guess who he was talking about. George Washington was sitting right there presiding over the convention. But Franklin then goes on to say, after that, we'll be on the road to an elected monarchy. And this is what they feared, putting one man in charge of the army. Would we have an elected king? George Mason, another very, very important founder, writes at the time or says at the time, we're on the road to something worse than the British system of a monarchy. We're on the road to an elected monarchy. And he said the people won't stand for it. They've been through the revolution. They will rise up against this if it happens. So this was a real fear, and that's why the separation of powers, the checks and balances they put in were so significant to these men.
Why did Washington sort of self-limit his own time in the White House? Or it wasn't the White House at the time, but
it was not
in the
White
presidency.
House at the time, but in the executive department, as they called it originally. He knew when he was sitting there in the Constitutional Convention that he, when they were talking about the president, he knew and everyone else knew they were talking about him, as Franklin had put it on the first day. There was really no dispute. There was really no question that, the only question was, did he want to do it? And he seemed reluctant at first, but he really did believe in this experiment that, in Republican government that they had created. He was one of the prime movers in accepting the invitation to come to the Constitutional Convention. And if Washington hadn't come, the people wouldn't have bought this idea in the first place. Nor would they have accepted the Constitution if he and Benjamin Franklin, perhaps the two most influential men of their day, had not been very, very much in favor of the Constitution in those days when it was being ratified. So Washington kind of knew from the start that he was in for it for at least one term as president. After his first term in office, he thought about leaving. He had actually written his first farewell address and then stuck it in a drawer. He was begged, please stay. And then he did run for a second term, of course, and was easily reelected. But then it was time for him to leave. He was ready to go back home to Mount Vernon. He was old. He was tired. The plantation had been not run well in his absence, and he knew it was time to move on. And that if this great experiment was going to work, the election of his successor was a very, very important thing. And he really stayed out of that for the most part, although he kind of gave the quiet nod to John Adams, his vice president, who had been pretty much frozen out of any significant decisions in those years. By the way, the election of Washington is an interesting one where it's so removed from what we think of today as elections. There were no candidates, no parties, no nominating conventions. There were no delegates. There weren't even truly candidates. Each state had the number of electors that had been granted under the Constitution, and those electors wrote down two names. And the first name would the man with the most votes was the president, and the man with the second most votes was vice president. Unanimously, George Washington was selected, but only 10 of the 13 states actually participated. Two, North Carolina and Rhode Island, hadn't ratified the Constitution yet, and New York, one of the most important states and most populous, didn't get its nominees, its electors, in on time. They missed the deadline because the legislature couldn't decide on it. So they blew it in the first election, and the New York's eight votes didn't even count. So it was a rather extraordinary election, and as I said, they were improvising the presidency from the beginning, and then Washington came into office and said, I walk on untrodden ground. He knew that everything he would do as president would create a precedent for his successors.
Why was the seat of the early government moved out of Philadelphia and to Washington, D.C.?
Well, it was moved to New York first. Mm-hmm. Washington is sworn in New York City in Federal Hall, and so that is truly the first federal capital. Part of it was that they didn't want Pennsylvania to become too predominant. Where the national capital was going to be was an important decision not only of politics but of real estate and economy, and they knew even though the federal government would be small in terms of what we think of it as, it would still be very, very influential and people would flock to the Capitol and it would be a very, very good thing. So New York was a temporary compromise. And then after that they said, we're going to create this new capital, and it was basically a real estate deal between Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson to move it to where Washington, D.C. is now located. In that 10 years that they needed to build the city, Philadelphia became the temporary capital. So real estate and political dealing go into this very, very significant decision in our history.
Kenneth C. Davis is with us. His new book is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment and invite you to join us at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Kenneth C. Davis. His new book is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. That's where we hear from Nicole, who writes, do you think that we could get to a point where all the states would be required to at least proportionally divide their electors based on popular vote, or at least by the winner in congressional districts like Maine and Nebraska?
I don't think it's going to happen because it hasn't happened yet, and it doesn't seem to be. There's a great hue and cry for that. As you mentioned, Maine and Nebraska are the only two of the 50 states that do have that proportional division. But, you know, Chris, as we look at the history of how this election process worked, first of all, we're talking about 1789, which, by the way, Washington elected that year. It's the only odd year that a presidential election took place. That's another curiosity about 1789. After that, of course, they get onto the four-year in the even years calendar. But every decision made that each state that came in tended to open up voting to more people. Vermont was the 14th state. All white males over 21 could vote, whether you own property or not. Tennessee was the same when it came into the Union. Even in some of the northern states, African Americans who owned property could vote. So the process was gradually opening up, and then every amendment that changed the Constitution, the 15th, giving the former slaves, African American males, the vote, the women's vote in 1920, the vote that gave presidential electors to the District of Columbia. Before 1960, people in Washington, D.C. could not vote for president. And then, of course, 1971, we get 18-year-olds getting the vote. And then things like the Voting Rights Act and the end of poll taxes have all opened the process up to more democracy rather than less. And I think that ultimately we'll head in that direction. And I just don't know if it will take this end of the Electoral College with a constitutional amendment or if there'll be some other way to do it. Could other states go in that direction? It's possible. I don't see a great movement towards it. I really think it's going to take a groundswell of people resisting. And unfortunately, it might take another election like 2000 or four other times in our history where the popular winner lost the electoral vote to get people to change that. So we'll see what happens. One other really important point about this electoral college as they created it that I want to mention, because many people don't get this in civics class, is that we of course know that each state got electors based on their representation in Congress. Nowadays, that means 435 congressmen, 100 senators, and three votes for the District of Columbia. That's 538 total electors. Back then, it was obviously smaller, but the way they counted people for determining the census that determined how many votes you had in Congress, and hence your electors, included slaves. They counted slaves as three-fifths of a person. That's a famous compromise made in the original Constitution. What did that mean in practical terms? Well, it meant a state like Virginia that was actually smaller in its free white population than Pennsylvania or Massachusetts actually had more electors. And that's one reason why four of our first five presidents are slaveholders from Virginia. Five of the first seven presidents are slaveholders, and most presidents before the Civil War came from slaveholding states or were sympathetic to slaveholders. This was a very, very important piece of presidential politics before the Civil War, and it's one of the real reasons that slavery was such a deep, abiding political issue, not just a moral question, or certainly not just an economic question, although it was both of those.
I had never read before your book that Thomas Jefferson had this interesting plan to sort of populate the country with sugar maples, and he believed that that could someday, in the future, eliminate the need for slave labor.
Well, Thomas Jefferson is such an extraordinary contradiction. As we all know, the man who writes, "All men are created equal," he knew that slavery was a complete contradiction to what he believed in, what he wrote, what he had fought for, yet he went home to a plantation dependent on slave labor. His idea, and this was actually came through one of the other signers of the Declaration, a fascinating man named Benjamin Rush, who was a friend of both Franklin and Adams and Jefferson. Benjamin Rush knew that slavery was about economy, and he thought that if they could replace the most important product that slaves then produced, which was sugar cane from the West Indies, that that would really dent slavery's impact. And he suggested and tried to come up with a plan to introduce maple sugar as a substitute for processed white sugar from the sugar cane of the West Indies mostly. Jefferson got very interested in this idea and started to plant maples at Monticello in the hope that he could participate this. It never really took hold. It just wasn't practical enough. There were certainly very, very powerful men in America who were making an awful lot of money from importing sugar from the West Indies, and they didn't want to see an end to it. And that's, again, the economic side of the slavery question that often gets overlooked when we talk about how important this issue was in early American history.
And ultimately, the only people that he'd kept in slavery that he ultimately emancipated, Jefferson here, are the ones believed to be his own children. Is that right?
That's correct. And this is still a controversy. This is, of course, the relationship between Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. It was examined again recently in an exhibit at the Smithsonian, this very, very complex relationship he has with his slaves and between his principals and his slaves. The current thinking is that Jefferson may likely have been the father of these children. They were emancipated in his will. These are the children of Sally Hemings. And by the way, I have to point out also, this is not a subject that some historian discovered 200 years later. This was a campaign charge in 1804. So when people think that somehow campaigning was nicer and neater and tidier 200 years ago, that's nonsense. That's a complete myth. So the whole Thomas Jefferson slave Sally Hemings issue came up in the presidential campaign. He never spoke about it publicly, but it was talked about back then. And so this is, the troubling part of Thomas Jefferson and his biography. And what I've always tried to do in my books that don't know much about series is get at the human side of the story, not from a scandalous or voyeuristic side, but just to look at these people as real people. They had egos, they had ambitions, they had personal agendas, and we have to take those into account when we see them and not just see the marble statue on the side of Mount Rushmore or the face on the dollar bill.
So Washington, our first president, gets an A-plus in your rating system. I think you gave Adams a B and Jefferson an A. I was struck by the fact that Abraham Lincoln, an A-plus if ever we had one, was immediately preceded by two Fs and an incomplete.
Yes, because the presidents who preceded him did so little to appropriately avert the coming of the Civil War and may have done things, in fact, to hasten it. And so for that, they've largely been judged failures, and I do grade them with Fs in my book, especially James Buchanan. Of course, Lincoln's successor, Andrew Johnson, is also a failure because he came onto a scene that demanded and needed great leadership. Lincoln was dead. The country was in ruins and shambles, torn apart by the Civil War. 2% of the American population dead over those 4 years. That's an astonishing idea to me. And he not only failed to act in a way that would help bring the country together, he did the absolute worst things in many respects. And this has nothing to do with his being impeached, the first president to be impeached, although he was acquitted. But that was a political thing, and everything to do with his personality and his demeanor and his approach to solving problems. So that's why he ranks as one of the Fs. And you're right, I do grade each of the 43 men who became president, A-plus down to F, with a few incompletes thrown in, mostly for the men who succeeded to the as vice presidents and really didn't serve long enough or died too soon. Like William Henry Harrison, hard to grade a man who was only in office for 30 days.
So even Herbert Hoover, much maligned for failing to ward off the Great Depression, gets a C in your book. What have we forgotten about Hoover's redeeming qualities?
Well, first of all, I want to speak about Hoover as a man, the redeeming qualities as a man. What many people do not know about Herbert Hoover, first of all, born in Iowa, first born president west of the Mississippi, but also born and turned an orphan. By the time he was 9, sent out to live with family in on the West Coast. So many of the presidents lost one or both parents. It's quite an extraordinary story in itself, particularly in the early going, in the 19th century. And the fact that a Hoover is able to pull himself up and get a great education and become truly a self-made millionaire, multimillionaire. But then during World War I, he turned his attentions, without government assistance or anything, to aiding the refugees and the people in Europe who were starving from World War I. And then after the war was over, he did a similar effort, now assisted by the United States government, in helping avert a tremendous famine in what was now Soviet Russia. So his humanitarian efforts before he became president probably saved millions of lives, and it's just part of the Hoover story that gets left out. Hoover was depicted as, for a long time, as a person who absolutely did nothing to avert the Depression, and then did nothing during the Depression to try and solve some of the problems. First of all, the president doesn't have magical powers to just do everything and anything. Hoover tried. He tried too little, too late. And while he was judged very harshly in the immediate aftermath, more recent histories have tended to treat him a little bit more kindly and acknowledge that he was trying to do something. It was just the enormity of the problem was beyond any one man's doing.
We also tend to forget that it took FDR quite some time to help the country pull out of the Depression.
This is absolutely the case. You know, in 1932, he takes over, and the country is in truly the worst years of the Depression, with bank failures at every turn, millions and millions unemployed. The unemployment rate peaked at around 24%, and that's the official rate. Most economic historians would say it was definitely much higher than that. Mm. But 4 years later, even after all the things that that Roosevelt was trying, the country was still very much mired in depression. The New Deal, the so-called 100 days, all the things that he introduced did not solve the problems that the country and the world was facing overnight. The unemployment rate in 36, when he ran for a second term, was an astonishing 17% by modern standards, completely unacceptable, which goes to show that it's not always the economy stupid. Presidents aren't always just turned out of office because the economy is bad and the unemployment rate is high. What is the president doing to address it? Do the people trust him? Do the people think he has their best interests in heart? Become much more important issues than a simple number of unemployed lining the streets.
So FDR, of course, is the only president to serve more than two terms. And then after he died, we established that two-term limit. Why do you think that may not have been such a good idea?
Well, I don't think it was a good idea because the framers didn't think it was a good idea. You know, we talk so much about the original ideas of the Constitution, the original intent. They did not think, and they were very clearly very, very worried about a president getting too much power, but they did not limit the president to two terms. And so I understand that that people, especially the Republicans who were then in control of the of the Congress by the time FDR had won his fourth term and then died, really did not want that to happen again. And so they were largely behind the movement to limit the president's term, to avert what they called at the time, or has been called, the imperial presidency. But, you know, I think from a practical sense, not to put this, I'm not suggesting it, but as an example, that a Bill Clinton who has served two terms is not able to run again, because that is what the Constitution says. But certainly he's might be an older and wiser president now. And I'm not speaking for him. I don't know if he would be interested in running for the job again.
Well, it seemed clear when he went to the convention that he wouldn't mind being back there.
Well, he was very much at home there, wasn't he? And whether he'd make a first gentleman or not is another question entirely, and one I'm sure we'll be talking about all too soon, probably the day after the the election results are in. We'll start talking about, and I hate to even say it, 2016. But certainly, you know, Barack Obama might be a perfectly good example of it as well. If he were reelected, just an if, he would that not be able to serve again? But he's a young man. Why not step out for 4 years and come back? Or if he were doing such a great job, why not keep him in office? I think that speaks to the idea that people should be able to get to vote for whomever they want, and that was the original intent of the Constitution, and I think we should probably go back to that. If people don't want a president for a third time, they have all the votes they need to keep him out. And here in New York, I'm speaking to you from New York, we had this question come up about Mayor Bloomberg, well-known mayor who took over New York City in the midst of the 9/11 crisis, mm-hmm. and was a very good mayor, and then got the term limits overturned so that he could be reelected to a third term. People didn't like it, but he won. And he's, I would say most people would agree that he's been a very effective mayor over his terms. But would New York be better served if he hadn't been able to run again? I don't know. I think it's a question worth exploring.
I guess it depends how much you like sugary sodas.
Or at least very, very large.
Very large sugary sodas. Kenneth C. Davis is my guest. He's author of the new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, call 1-800-933-5372 or send an email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. History, literature, and film courses in October take you from Renaissance Italy to the American character. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Kenneth C. Davis, author of the Don't Know Much series of history books. The latest is called Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. You can join our conversation by emailing think@kera.org. And that's where we hear Ken from Teresa in Bedford, who writes, I've heard many of the presidents are distantly related and many can be found on the same family trees. Is there any truth to this? And I can think of Adams, Harrison, the Adamses, the Harrisons, the Roosevelts, and of course the Bushes. Am I missing any?
Well, there are, you know, if you go out, really fan out on the genealogical trees, you find some connections, but no clear specific family connections other than the ones you just mentioned. Of course, John Adams and his son John Quincy Adams, the first father and son. William Henry Harrison and Benjamin Harrison, grandfather and grandson. Then the Roosevelts were cousins, and the Bushes, of course, again, father and son. One of the interesting connections I have discovered over the years, going back to being interested in things Thanksgiving-y, is that eight presidents are Mayflower descendants, and including some of these we just mentioned. The Adamses, obviously, were Mayflower descendants, living in Massachusetts when they did. They had direct descent, but so did Franklin D. Roosevelt, and the Bushes did as well. Ulysses S. Grant, and there were a couple of others that escaped my mind at the moment, but that's an interesting family connection. But beyond that, no, there aren't really any close family relationships. You start getting into, you know, second and third cousins and genealogical roots that go way, way out, but no more direct descendants than those, direct connections.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Steve in Euless. Hi, Steve.
Hey, thank you very much, Chris.
Sure.
Mr. Davis, a big fan. When my son was in junior high, I would read him bedtime stories, basically, out of your books. And give him an idea.
Well, he probably slept well then.
Yes, and he's a totally twisted individual. So.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it. I'll take that as a compliment.
You better do that. It's a kind of a minor aside. The power of the small states or low population states was something I don't think that the founders totally anticipated, though they did put in the codicil about, you know, 3/5 of a human being for slavery. And Aaron Burr giving us the filibuster left us with the system where 16% of the population can basically totally stymie anything going through in the Senate. So I wanted to get your reactions to that.
Okay, let me take the first one first, the small states. This was certainly part of the initial problem of the Constitution, as you probably know if you remember your high school civics class, that at the Constitutional Convention they were afraid that if America's legislature were based just on population alone, small states would be overwhelmed by larger, more populous states, and this was not only a factor in the legislature, but then, of course, would affect the electors as well. And that is why they wanted to create the electoral the electoral system as we know it, and also to create two houses of Congress, one based on population and one in which each state would get the two senators. So that was the compromise that created the Congress as we know it. But it carried over, of course, into the Electoral College because the electors were based on the representation in Congress. And you can certainly see the theoretical underpinnings of that working. It also had to do in part with slavery because part of the fear was that they could see that the northern free states were growing very, very rapidly with immigration, whereas the southern states, the slaveholding states, were growing more slowly. And that was a fear that was built into this compromise as well. On the filibuster, this is an idea that does go back a long time, but what you see in the history of the filibuster, where one senator could basically tie up the Senate unless 60 senators agree to cloture or stopping the filibuster. This was thought of as an important idea, but it was very, very rarely used. I know we want to think about Jimmy Stewart doing it in that great old movie about
Mr. Smith going to Washington.
Frank Capra's one of his great Democratic movies. But it really wasn't used all that much until much more recently. Its impact has become much more pronounced in recent times, and it reflects to some degree the increase in the partisanship, the stark partisanship in Congress, and which was always less so in the Senate, which was a little bit more collegial, a little bit more my good friend from getting along with each other, whereas the House, of course, is because it was a little closer to the people and being elected every 2 years.
A little scrappier,
but so I think that the tradition was certainly is an old one, but its use has been evolving, and it's something that I know a lot of people want to think about a little bit. But it's really not a constitutional issue; it's really a Senate rules issue, and getting 100 senators to agree on some things sometimes can be difficult, as we well know.
Hey, why is William McKinley at the top of your list of the underappreciated presidents?
He is on the top of my list partly because he gets overshadowed so quickly and abruptly by the largest of life of presidents, Theodore Roosevelt. Mm-hmm. William McKinley is a fascinating character. Again, the biographies of these men are extraordinary. Once again, not orphaned, but lost his father at a very early age. His mother struggled on a small farm in Ohio, on the what was then the wilderness of Ohio. He goes and takes a job at 16. The Civil War comes. He enlists in the Civil War. He's driving a buckboard and delivering meals to the front lines at the Battle of Antietam. He's rewarded for his valor and makes his way up through the ranks. Eventually gets into politics, becomes a well-educated man. And he is such an interesting character because he stands at the cusp between the 19th century and the 20th century, of course, leads America through the Spanish-American War very reluctantly. He said he had seen war. He didn't really want to bring the nation into war. But it's a short and, by all accounts, a successful war because America really becomes, for the first time, a global player under William McKinley, with the possessions that are acquired. He's starting to bring America into the 20th century and starting to create a modern presidency in some respects when he is assassinated in September of 1901, leading the way for Theodore Roosevelt to become the president at 42, the youngest American president still. Just to back up for one moment, McKinley's first president, vice president, had been Garrett Hobart, very successful, quite acclaimed as a vice president, a very good one. But he died just before the second term, and so they sought a new vice president to run with McKinley. And in New York, where Governor Roosevelt was then trying to reform the state, the Republicans in power really wanted to get rid of him, so they pushed him onto the McKinley ticket. And somebody famously said at the time, "Don't you realize there's only one life between this madman," meaning Theodore Roosevelt, "and the presidency?" And, of course, those words were all too prophetic. So McKinley is a fascinating character. Also interesting to see how really well-liked he was by everyone. And that's much harder to find among our presidents, somebody who's well-liked by both sides. He was considered a true gentleman. He was widely and easily reelected to his second term. The country was coming into a more prosperous time and emerging into the 21st century. And he probably would have been much more famous had he gotten to serve out his second term. And maybe Theodore Roosevelt would be much less famous.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Carla in Weatherford. Hi, Carla.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thank you.
My question is, especially with all the partisans in Congress now, why is it that no one has ever asked even the question that I've heard, why don't we have term limits for Congress?
Term limits for Congress. A little hard to hear on that line. Were you able to hear that? Why don't we have term limits for Congress?
I did not hear it at first, but now I do. Well, there's no term limits for Congress because Congress would have to pass term limits for itself. And I guess this is where self-interest takes over in terms of maybe the general interest. But I would go back again to my original point when we were discussing the term limits for the presidency, that there is a way to limit terms in Congress. It's to get out and vote. And, of course, we understand the powers of the incumbency, but I think that there are other ways to address those powers. For instance, we are now in the midst of, we all have talked about the amount of money being spent in this campaign and how the advertising goes and these super PACs and private money and secret money coming in and influencing elections. It seems to me that that's a bigger issue to address and getting some kind of reform of campaign financing and funding than the addressing the question of term limits. There are some very, very good congressmen who serve many, many terms, and they have throughout history. So I think it's sometimes a dangerous area to get into when you say, oh, this guy has been there for X number of years, he shouldn't be there any longer. That could finally and ultimately, sure, it will get rid of some of the bums, but it might get rid of some of the really good, effective, hardworking congressmen who deserve to be there.
Well, and it's my understanding, and correct me if this is incorrect, but that term limits weren't really even necessary until, say, the beginning part of the 20th century, when more money started coming in, and that had a big impact on who got elected. And because before that, it was expensive to be in Congress because you weren't doing your regular job and you didn't have other sources of income.
Well, that's one of the reasons that it started to change in the late 19th century. You're right. You had to have a certain amount of money to be a congressman, because it meant having a home in Washington and keeping up appearances, and it was also becoming more expensive to as Congress met for longer sessions and all those practical sides. So by the end of the 19th century, the Senate had become known as Millionaire's Row, because very, very wealthy men had come to dominate politics, American politics, especially in the Senate. And, for instance, I mentioned the man who says this about Theodore Roosevelt. That man was Mark Hanna, very wealthy industrialist from Ohio. One of the senators from Montana was a big copper mining magnate. So these were the people who had the time and money to run and to make a career of being in office. And that certainly added to the idea then that incumbency was started to become a self-fulfilling prophecy.
We have an email here from Joel who wants to know why third parties have become less relevant in presidential elections and if we will ever return to a point where they would be a real contender.
It's an excellent point and a very, very important one, and it's one that I spend a lot of time talking about. Third parties throughout history have never been truly significant in terms of nearly electing a president, with the exception of 100 years ago when Theodore Roosevelt, who we've been speaking about a little bit, ran as a third-party candidate as a bull moose or progressive. And he had done that because he left the Republican Party when they renominated Taft in a very, very mean-spirited, nasty primary campaign that left Taft, who was the incumbent president, as the nominee. Taft and Roosevelt then split the Republican vote pretty much. Roosevelt finished second, but that really led to the election of Woodrow Wilson in 1912. It's a real turning point election in many ways. But that, in all of American history, was the most successful third party campaign, a former president. Most of the times, third parties have been the spoiler. They've really kept someone from being elected rather than having a good chance to do it themselves or electing someone else. And so people have been very, very wary of third parties, especially since 2000. I think clearly Ralph Nader's impact as a candidate in several states in 2000 has made people more wary of the idea that their vote for a third-party candidate is really going to just mean that somebody they don't like will be elected president.
Kenneth C. Davis is author of the new book, Don't Know Much About the American Presidents. Ken, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for being with us.
It is fun, and just remind everybody to make sure they go and vote because it is a precious right. Thanks so much, Chris.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer with help today from Lindsay Connect. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download the podcast at kera.org/think. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.